Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Print Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you very much. For viewers at home, it's very, very important to note that just before the show started, I made a joke. It was a pun-like joke, and Nick found it funny. So I'm just saying that that's going on my CV. It has made my year.
Yes, a day to be remembered. And of course, we're also joined by Saragon. Sarah, how are you doing?
Very well. I also found it funny, I have to admit.
Yes, no, it is. Herman, like me, has a quantity over quality approach to humor. And this time, I think he hit the mark. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I'm, of course, coming to you without electricity because Fair Eskom is currently not blessing me with such, but that never stops the Daily Friend Show. So our first story is another one of these little pinpricks of data, which suggests that the ANC is going to be in for a rough 2024 election. So we've been following closely by-elections around the country. The general pattern seems to be that in some places, like, for example, the suburbs of Soweto, as well as bits of the Northern Cape, the ANC is really taking a beating, as well as in Limpopo and in Mpumalanga, the ANC is pretty strong. It maintains its hold on those communities pretty strongly. But there's some new data out now. So there were two by-elections yesterday across the country. One was in the Richards Bay municipality, which is currently controlled by the IFP. However, the ward in question, which is Ward 12, I believe, has never been won by the IFP in its entire history. So the IFP governs this municipality, Richards Bay, through a coalition with the DA, EFF, ACDP, and Freedom Front Plus. So that must be quite an interesting council chamber there. But this ward, which I think... in 2000, the IFP got its best ever result here, where it got about 40% of the vote, was still won by the ANC with over 50%. In 2021, the IFP only got 25% of the vote in this ward. However, yesterday, the IFP won this ward with an outright majority, 54% of the vote. And what's even better for the IFP is that the turnout was higher than it was in 2021 by quite a large margin. So that's a bit shocking for the ANC, which is losing what is essentially on a very small scale a KZN stronghold. Furthermore, in the Prince Albert municipality, which is in the very dry, deserty bits of the Western Cape, south of the N1, south of Beaufort West, very desolate part of the country, small municipality, less than 15,000 people, or around about that many. This municipality has been governed, I think, by a DA-led coalition in the past. However, its current government, or at least until Wednesday, its current government consisted of the ANC, a local Karoo party called the KGP, and the Patriotic Alliance, who together ruled the municipality. However, the DA has just defeated the KGP's leader and the current mayor, I believe, in his Ward 4. The DA here managed to increase their vote by quite a lot. In 2021, they only got 30% of the vote. Yesterday, they got 51% of the vote. And what's even more shocking for the ANC-KGP-PA coalition in this municipality was they all put their resources together in this by-election. There was only the candidate from the KGP, and he was endorsed by both the PA and the ANC in the municipality. And if the results were the same as last time, with the PA getting 11%, the ANC getting 11%, and the KGP getting 32% in this ward, they should have walked away with it. But the DA managed to grow by, it looks, around 20% in this municipality. And this has always been a KGP stronghold. It's a little bit difficult to kind of trace it back historically because the ward's boundaries have moved a little bit. But the DA have traditionally not really done that well here, at least since 2000, which was the last time they did well in this municipality. And they've now taken it. So it looks like bad news for ANC coalitions around. So Herman, I think I'm going to ask you this question first. Let's look at the Prince Albert municipality first, right? it looks to me like what happened here was people were perfectly willing to vote for the KGP when they thought that it might be in opposition to the ANC. And that once it formed a coalition government with the ANC, the DA was able to hang that around their necks and destroy them. What do you make of it?
I think that's quite right. And I sort of share a sentiment with someone we all know, Martin van Staden, who recently tweeted out begrudgingly almost that he hates to to admit it, but there's some merit to the age-old and very much vilified angle taken by the DA at election time that, you know, don't waste your vote on a small party. And of course, strictly speaking, looking at the electoral system, there isn't really such a thing as a wasted vote, because both national and national, provincial and local government level, you've got a PR representative element, which makes sure that, you know, very few votes can be qualified as wasted. But we are entering a phase where we are starting to see political wastage of votes and the consequences of that, perhaps not numerically and in terms of actual results. But the argument that the DA has been making might actually now be starting to take root amongst voters. This is certainly a very, very small indication that it might be the case. It's not sufficient to claim, you know, the voters are buying into this. But the dangers of parties without a firm track record, without a firm ideological stance, without the, you know, brand recognizability of the bigger parties, they really become something of an unknown factor at election time at local government level. And it seems that the DA, as you say, have now actually managed to convert that argument that they've been making for as long as I can remember, into an actual potent force to convince voters not to go with a small local party like the KGP. And now, whatever the merits of that, I do think it is significant, because it portends quite well for the idea of coalition formation in 2024 and perhaps, you know, the next municipal elections and then 2029 ultimately. It adds, I think, a very, very welcome element of voters engaging with politics and governance seriously that I think has been missing before.
I think one of the things we're probably going to see in the lead up to next election is a lot of opposition parties declaring their stances on coalitions with the ANC. And they will have to be upfront if they want to win voters' loyalties to say, look, we will only go into a coalition with these people, or maybe we'll only go into a coalition with the ANC if they do X, Y, or Z, or whatever. And I think that this would be very healthy development for our democracy for a number of reasons, one of which is that it would actually refocus some of the conversation on policy.
Yes. And also, well, what it will add, it will give more information to the voter, because if someone comes out ahead of an election saying we won't go into coalition with the ANC and they go into coalition with the ANC, the voter can take away some insights from that. Where up until now, where contests have been so predetermined, so decided, and the balance of power was so difficult to shift, we are starting to see it become more an everyday occurrence where municipalities turn on one or two seats. And it's not unlikely that provincial, even national government might within the next decade face very similar circumstances where literally one or two seats determine who can govern, who can form a government. We shouldn't forget that Helen Ziller became mayor of Cape Town originally by, I think, the closest of margin. I think it was like 106 to 104 or something. It was one seat. So these things have been, we wonks who've been watching politics, we've been familiar with the power of a single swing seat in terms of, is it a small party that control it, that's a bit of a loose cannon, or is it a more established party that you can predict and rely on, crucially, on national structures to inform how that party behaves? Because that's also something that we shouldn't, that we shouldn't ignore, is the fact that if you have a party like the DA that has good structures quite down the line, you can be relatively certain that the national policy of government coalition formation will filter through to your local representatives. The IFP, however, a weaker structure, so you might actually elect a rogue councillor. So the reliability of coalition partners is, I think, a very, very welcome dimension to the discussion. And it informs voters. It gives us more of a sense of what's the point of voting for this party over that party.
And I think it's probably a wake-up call for parties like Al Jamaha, which when they campaign in places like Tunisia, where they have a ward seat, they take a very strong anti ANC line. They say, you know, we are the main opposition party. The DA is useless. They don't oppose the ANC in this, and this way, and we'll actually represent you and talk for you. And then they form coalition with the ANC council. Sara, what do you make of all this? I mean, firstly, do you have anything to say about what Homer just said, and also just about the IFP? There was this kind of feeling, I guess, around 2011, maybe 2016, that the IFP was just not in a great place. It had had this breakaway when the NFP took a lot of its votes all across the country. It lost a bunch of municipalities to the NFP and ANC going into coalition with each other. Magosuthu Buthelezi Gacha is getting much older, and you know he's retired now as leader of the party. And there was this feeling that the IFP might be on its last legs, and here it seems to have clawed back some votes. And in fact, and made it real advancements, not just clawing back, but actually winning in a place that it hasn't won before. What do you make of all this, Sara?
Look, I can't, I have no inside track on the IFP's, you know, why people are responding to the IFP specifically. But I suspect it has a lot to do with the fact that notwithstanding that, I mean, I think you and I couldn't recall the name of the leader of the IFP, and I can't recall his name now. And that should be a problem. But the reality is that the IFP does represent a certain constituency. And I think it's probably more a response to the fact that the ANC is literally imploding. I mean, it is doing so badly. It is governing so badly, both at a local and a provincial and a national level, that I think it's that point of sticking to something that has a certain resonance that people are connected to and is there in opposition predominantly to the ANC. And I suspect that is the main reason for the change. In other words, it may not have the dynamism or the brand recognition that it did under Buthelezi, but it does have brand recognition. It has been around a fairly long time. It is in opposition, and it is a Zulu party. And I think that combination of factors would have brought people out. And particularly, as you raised the point, it was the amount of people, the number of people who voted, the high percentage of voters suggest disaffection.
In both of these by-elections, there was, I think, something like a more than 60%, more than 65% turnout in both of them, which is much higher than in previous.
And for what it's worth, as I recall, in both elections, the EFF, which is not there in the bigger numbers, sort of hit the below 1% level, which in itself, I think, says something as well. As we know, you can't read into local election, into national elections, what you see from by-elections. But I think in the current climate we're in, A, we're looking desperately for signals of where things are going. And B, I think because we're in such a dreadful state, we might be reading a bit too much into it, but at the same time, it doesn't feel as irrelevant as it might have been in the last municipal election or the municipal election before, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah.
Well, I wonder what effect the fact that the IFP actually governs this municipality now, which is, I believe, at least for the first time since, the mid-2000s, what effect that had had. Maybe voters like what they see and are responding to it, or maybe the ANC has just lost some of its grip on the patronage strings here, and that is...
Can I just make an observation on that? I suspect it also is an indication, notwithstanding all the bluster, of Zuma's power dissipating. Because it was Zuma's power, presence, force of personality that got the ANC up in that period in the first place.
Yeah.
And I think it's a sign that's gone.
But I do think we should be careful about the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal. It is a very, very strange beast. There is the possibility that the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal is sort of sabotaging their own interests here to weaken to gain a factional upper hand and saying, look what Ramaphosa's leadership is leading to here. There were allegations similar to that to the DA leadership in Gauteng with the previous municipal elections, where there was this idea of, this faction might benefit from the party doing badly here and there and there. So it's a difficult one to call. But what is interesting is the turnout is so good. Mm-hmm. If it was very low turnout, then my theory of sabotage might be more believable. But because turnout isn't that low, it's actually higher than it was in the municipal elections last year, it seems to indicate a genuine organic shift away from the ANC for whatever reason. But I want to add something here that we shouldn't, that I do think is very, very important. And that is, for so long in South African politics, the outcome of elections have been preordained and predetermined. So what you quite often have is substandard politicians occupying opposition positions because there was no real chance of gaining power. And it, if you are a talented politician, would you really want to be in a position where you fight an election and then you don't win, you don't have influence in government? So the predetermined nature, or the expectation of predetermined nature of election outcomes, has, I think, over the last 10 years sort of led to a diminishing in the quality of opposition politics. And my hope genuinely is, and this really depends on voters, is that that would start to change, that as it becomes possible for the ANC to lose, for better people to come in power, better people will be attracted to the possibility of investing in something like a political career.
I think that's a really good point. For so many years, for a lot of South Africans, the ANC was synonymous with politics. Mm. You were in the ANC if you wanted to be a politician, otherwise you weren't in politics. You would go into the private sector or the civil service or something like that. And so if you weren't on board with the ANC, well, then what's the point? Because maybe you can get a seat in the DA, but, maybe you don't like them that much, or maybe you're not confident you can get a seat there, or maybe there's this other small party, but whatever. So, yeah, I think that that there may be a lot more interest now and a lot more enthusiasm, not just from people who might join opposition parties saying, hey, we might actually be able to win, but also opposition voters are going to be seeing things like this around the country and think to themselves, wow, we actually can win. And I think that is the opposition's biggest secret weapon come 2024, is the fact that everyone who is against the ANC is going to think to themselves, we might actually do it this time. But that depends on the opposition getting the data and the info and their message out to people.
A last thing from me, it's a solid trope in sort of this sort of campaigning messaging, is it's always better, always better. And we've been seeing this from the DA for many, many years, at least since 2009. It's always better to tell your supporters that you've got a chance to win. Yeah. And up until now, that promise has sounded hollow. But now, for the first time, the Freedom Front Plus, the DA, the IFP, can actually come to an election saying, look, guys, there's everything to play for, and it won't sound just like yabba yabba poster chat.
And I must say that the Freedom Front Plus, I think, has, in terms of its messaging, been very cunning about adapting to the new environment. Mm-hmm. I think there was a recent by-election where their slogan on their banners was, your reliable coalition partner. And that, I think, suggests that we are moving into a new world, and I suspect more parties will follow. Anyway, okay, let's move on to our next story. This one, I don't know how much there is to say about it because we're definitely going to come back to it, but we've had some very good news on the expropriation bill. So there was going to be a decision yesterday taken at the Committee on Public Works, where the expropriation bill was going to be moved forward towards the National Assembly, and MPs had a chance. This was one of the last chances they would have to delete some of the terrible clauses in the expropriation bill and make it legislation that's not so toxic. And it looks like the ANC has decided to stall the process at the last minute. according to one of the ANC MPs who was on the panel, who was on the committee. He said, we need to take a final re-look at the report. He said, quote, because we feel that as much as it has been presented to us as the ANC, I'm sure that we will need to take a final re-look at the report. And the AMP on the committee said, I certainly wasn't expecting that, but I fully support that proposal. So it looks like South Africa may, property rights in South Africa have been given yet another lease on life. Sarah, what do you make of this?
Yeah, and you know, as we've sort of often held the view that the more you can kick something into touch, the better chance there is of it not happening. So we, you know, it's a live in hope type of scenario, but be that as it may. I obviously like the theory that, you know, once President Ramaphosa has attended the Queen's funeral, that he's having this meeting with President Biden. And of course, the Americans, even if they know very little about South Africa, one thing they do know is if they want to invest, they want to know that their property rights are secure. And with any luck, I imagine one of the issues that will be raised is property rights and what has happened. And I think this might be part of the reason for the delay. If it is, it's then the conundrum is once Biden said, well, I hope you're not going ahead with it. And Cyril says, no, you know, we don't want to offend you. Next week, they're going to sit around the table with Ramaphosa and say, well, what are we going to do now? So it's very strange because, I mean, this has been, you know, this was the key point of the elective conference in 2017 when Cyril, you know, became the ANC president was, and he pursued it. He was very much the person who drove EWC through Parliament, in case anyone wants to know who to blame for it. So I think it's a very plausible, because the timing is just superb. But what other reasons there may or may not be, I'm not quite sure. I'm sure Herman can speculate.
Well, I'm
tempted to push back a little bit in that I don't perhaps have the same trust in the competence of the State Department as you do, Sarah, but I won't because I'm going to be applying for a visa soon to the US and I'm very scared.
don't misunderstand me. I have reservations as well. So that, it's like everything, as I say, it's a sort of, you know, prayer and a wing thing, wing and a prayer.
But so something that I do think is important to note here is people always, I think this has happened to you, Sarah, and you, Nick, is people coming to you and saying, what's the point? You make these parliamentary submissions, you know, try to contact MPs, you lobby these committees. Why bother? They're going to do what they want to do in any case. And this is a very good example of why that isn't such, why that cynicism and the predictability isn't always at play. It's not always clear why these politicians take the decisions they do. We were heavily, the IRR was heavily involved, led by, you know, our dear colleague, Longboy Gabriel Krause, in opposing this legislation. And it's not clear to us even, or to the members of the committee that we've spoken to, why exactly this delay has taken place. But from what we can see from the minutes of the meeting, listen from the recordings of the meetings, is there was this sort of tacit acknowledgement of the pressure that has been building on this issue. And quite often, a delay of this nature is the best victory you could possibly achieve, because next time we fight for another delay and another delay. There's no such thing as a permanent victory in the battle of ideas. Mm. So the point of this is you don't know what are the currents going on beneath the surface in a parliamentary committee. The EFF, we would have expected them to be fully in favor of this legislation, completely against it in this final reveal of the cards. So it is just, right, I think, a very good example.
And the reason the EFF is given is because it allows compensation in some circumstances for expropriation.
Yes, and that's beautiful. And it just shows that the pieces moving on the politics chessboard should never be taken too easily for granted. There's always room to influence, always room to push. And this is a very, I was solidly expecting us to fail in this regard. I was expecting yesterday this legislation to pass through that committee in its final wording off to the National Assembly, National Council of Provinces, onto the President's desk. And surprise, surprise, it didn't happen. And it just goes to show that if people like us who do this, you know, several hours a day can't exactly predict the outcome and the influence of IRR civil society type support, we shouldn't switch off too easily and think, oh, you know, it's gone. It's everything's gone. No, there's everything left to play for.
No, very well said. And that is, in fact, why we do what we do. Okay. Do you guys want to talk about foreign affairs or do you want to talk about the impeachment panel?
Foreign affairs.
Foreign affairs.
Okay. So
don't know what we're talking about, I'd rather talk about foreign affairs.
Okay. Yeah. So there's, I get the feeling, you know, I follow foreign affairs quite closely. And I get the feeling that we really are headed for a period of grave disruption. And we're beginning to see that across the world now. So I'm going to try and tie a whole bunch of different stories together. And some of them are related to, in some ways, I think, to the war in Ukraine, but also some of it is due to the larger geopolitical struggles going on, like such as between the US and China. So there is a report from the UN which fears that Syria could once again ignite into full-scale fighting. The Syrian civil war has been going on since 2011. I think it's cost hundreds of thousands of lives. It's displaced millions of people, created a refugee crisis in Europe. It's led to horrific human rights abuses. It's been, you know, Iran, America, Russia, Turkey, Israel, Saudi Arabia have all been involved in the conflict in some way. It's been a real mess. And it looks like it might be on the verge of flaring up again as there's been renewed fighting along the front lines, which have not been completely peaceful, but have been at least at a lower intensity over recent years. And that the primarily the Turkish-backed Syrian Free Army and al-Nusra Front in the north might be re-engaging in open conflict with Bashar al-Assad's Russian and Iranian-backed troops, who are looking to recapture the whole of the country after they almost lost control of it. At the same time, there is a war breaking out now between Armenia and Azerbaijan. It seems like Russia is distracted by the war in Ukraine, and so the Russian peacekeepers deployed on the border region, they have not been able to stop Azerbaijan attacking Armenian troops along a disputed territory there and across into Armenia itself, along its internationally recognized borders. Already at least 100 soldiers have been killed and possibly many more. At the same time, the US has promised that it is going to be delivering, I think, $4 billion in aid to Taiwan as part of a military defense package. Taiwan recently shot down a Chinese drone that was entering its airspace. At the same time, Israel and Iran seem ever closer to the brink of warfare as Iran gets closer to developing a nuclear weapon. And there's still a civil war going on in Libya, which involves both Russia and Turkey. So, yeah, a lot of these conflicts on a scale, I think, that is bigger than conflicts we've seen up till now, especially the Armenia-Azerbaijan one, which is, and of course, you know, Russia-Ukraine. But the conflicts around the globe seem to be at a higher intensity than I think what we've been used to for the past at least sort of 20 years or so. Sara, what are your thoughts?
Can I just say that the only thing I'll say is that as far as Russia is concerned, it's very interesting because it's so tied up in Ukraine. It cannot, I don't think it can play the dominant role in Syria that it played before. I don't think it has the manpower, the armaments, and I don't think it has the political energy to be one of the sort of the main brokers in that. And I think that from that point of view, the other parties, people like Turkey, et cetera, will probably predominate. But I also think with respect to Syria, and I'll only comment on this, is to say that although the Russians were responsible for keeping Assad in power, I think he's weak and he's a tyrant, committed many human rights abuses. So I think without a country taking position like Russia, I think his position runs the risk of becoming precarious again.
Right. He's going to lean more on Iran, which has its own plans. Herman, I know you're about to be load shed, but any final thoughts on this topic before we
No, I think it, I just want to make a similar observation actually to the previous one, is that the fluctuation of ideas and never believe people that the status quo is so unassailable as it is. It's very interesting, and I'm only, you know, just past 30, but it's very interesting to start seeing historical chapters clearly emerging. You know, the 90s to 2000 bloom period, the war on terror for the first decade, the financial crash, and now, of course, another big event is COVID. It's very, very fascinating to see how these, every time there's a new global event, you think, oh, this is the new status quo. And it's just indicative that these things change constantly. And not just is that, you know, a risk and a concern, but it's also a great opportunity for new ideas to take hold.
Yes. Although hopefully with less shooting and more talking, I think would be more useful in some of these things. But yeah, anyway, we'll I'm sure we're going to be following these conflicts as they go on. And that is all the time we have for this week. So thank you very much for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the show. And we will be back next week on the Daily French Show. So cheers, everyone.